I'm so glad we can do this. Everything's impermanent, but each month that I come here, I'm happy to come here. And I just happen to be in transit. Actually, I live in northern New Mexico. I'm in transit to give a public talk in Tucson tomorrow night and then lead a residential retreat for the Tucson Community Meditation Center. And it's always nice to be with my homies before I go away. And it's just quite wonderful, actually. I've been offered a place to stay tonight by the Norbertine Center, the Catholic Center in the far South Valley. I've never been there before, but they're offering me their hermitage tonight, and they're actually going to shuttle me to the airport and back and save the Tucson Sangha the cost of parking. And I just wanted to mention that the Norbertine Center has started an ecumenical library, and they're doing a whole year of talks to honor the opening of their ecumenical library. It's called In Search of Spiritual Wisdom, that all may be one. So they're doing a series of talks, and I'm mentioning it this evening because I won't be coming here in March, and I'm going to be doing a presentation on April 18th. So feel free to come. I've left a bunch of flyers on the table back there. When I came here last month, I talked about all the kinds of happiness that the Buddha discussed, each one deeper and more refined and more powerful than the one before it. And I talked about how we can relate skillfully to all these forms of happiness. Basically, enjoy them without craving, grasping, and clinging. Very simple. This is really mostly about cultivating our individual happiness through the purification of our speech and our action in ethical conduct and the practice of generosity, and also through the purification of our consciousness through meditation. So we get to enjoy sense pleasures, the joy of speaking and acting in a harmonious way with others, ethical conduct, of non-harming, the happiness of calm, of peace, the happiness of rapture, of joyous interest in our experience, the happiness of bliss, the happiness of equanimity, of insight, the greatest happiness of nirvana. So that's all about a kind of individual cultivation. And I'd like to talk a little bit about not only our individual happiness, but our collective happiness, and one way that we can really support our collective happiness. The Buddha said he really encourages us to cultivate happiness. This whole path is about it. It's about reducing suffering and increasing happiness. We all want to be happy. So he said cultivate happiness, but he also said protect your happiness. And the way that we protect our happiness is basically through ethical conduct, through making an effort to be helpful in our speech, in our action, in our livelihood, or how we make our living, and trying not to harm. So So essentially our collective happiness is mostly supported by ethics, by our ethical conduct. And I'd like to talk about one aspect of this, how we can support each other's happiness. And it really has to do with the quality of how we communicate. And this is a very familiar subject to those of us who are familiar with the teachings. The aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path that we sometimes call right speech or skillful speech. And there's a reason, I think I may have given a talk on this subject just a few months ago. The reason I'm bringing it up again is that I've been prompted by a dramatic experience of unhappiness that I've been witnessing in the last few weeks. unhappiness that has come through communication. A couple of people that I know have been in quite intense conflict with each other. And thanks to the blessing of the internet, I get emails. Most of this communication has happened through emails. And both of these people have copied to me the exchanges. These two people could be anywhere in the world, you know, thanks to the internet. And what has happened is that one person, I won't go into the details, it doesn't matter, but one person made a request of the other refused. The first person was angry and blamed, and the second person was offended at being blamed and blamed back. And then all of a sudden, sort of all of these grievances that have been stored up for a long period of time got all trotted out. You did this and this and this, and you didn't do this, and you said this once. And so this exchange of volleys. Does this sound familiar at all? It's so common. Has anyone here not experienced that kind of interaction with someone else? Somebody offends you, you get angry back. And there can be this escalating quality. My sense is that things are starting to cool off. I've had to make a decision about whether to try to intervene or not, to try to mediate this process or just let it play out. And I've chosen to let it play out, at least for the time being, and may offer to mediate sometime later. But it's all too common. This kind of conflict of through communication, through our speech and our writing, this kind of conflict happens between individuals, it happens between communities, between ethnic groups and religious groups. It happens between and among nations. It is a very common pattern. It's familiar to us all. And it's extraordinarily destructive. Just in terms of our political discourse, I'm sure you've been aware of the fact that there's been almost like a civil war going on for the last few years between political factions in this country. Just stepping back away from whatever your principle, your political principles are, or your political opinions, just noticing the nature of the communication, especially in the world of talk radio and talk television. Extraordinary. Still happening. And there is an effort now for us to try to get beyond that kind of conflict or political civil war, to see if it's possible actually for us to deal with difficult problems in a harmonious way. I appreciate the leadership that is trying to get beyond this kind of sectarian divide. So this is a very familiar pattern to us. It's standard stuff. So this situation between two people that I know is a kind of microcosm, you know, for what could lead to, I mean, it's basically the same kind of situation that is happening between Israelis and Palestinians right now. Or the two wars that this country has been waging with our money and in our name for 7 years, more than 7 years now, at least in the case of one war. So to step back from this familiar pattern and to ask, is there a different way that we can do this? And for me personally, I feel that the fate of the earth depends on whether or not we can learn to do this differently. It's that important. This is not about some kind of exercise that we do in our lives. This is really about the absolute substance of our lives. Are we human beings going to learn how to live in harmony with ourselves and with other species on this planet? Or aren't we? Or Jahan Sadat, Anwar Sadat's wife, said after Anwar Sadat was assassinated, she said, we must love each other or die. So just to look at this one aspect, such a critical aspect, it feels to me that it's, for me at least, personally, this is the hardest aspect of ethical conduct. You know, it's so easy to be unskillful in our speech or in our writing. So I'd like to just share with you, and I know that many of you are really, really familiar with these teachings, perhaps some people here aren't, share with you the basic guidelines that the Buddha offered around communication. It's in many ways it's so simple, and it's so logical, and it's so practical, but it's not so easy to do. The Buddha said, try to refrain, and it's really a practice, in this practice of communication, which is central to our spiritual practice, as central as meditation. In this aspect of our practice, he said, try to refrain from one, lying, two, harsh speech, three, slander, and four, idle speech. I think that was that's an interesting one. I have some questions about that guideline, actually, because sometimes our idle speech is exactly the glue that holds us together as people. And the Buddha said that's what he suggested that we refrain from doing. He said, cultivate communication that is true, appropriate, and kind. And I think that that's just a fantastic formulation. So speak the truth, but we all know that we can use the truth as a kind of weapon to beat up on each other. And so speak the truth that is appropriate. In other words, you have to kind of understand the context of your speech. And speak with kindness, even in the midst of a conflictual situation. Do you think that's possible? Is that an impossible practice for us, to refrain from forms of communication that cause separation and pain, and to practice or to cultivate forms of communication that bring connection and happiness? It's essentially what these guidelines are about. It's so useful to have this, essentially this training, this information. And I found in this situation with these two people that I know, the first thing I did was, you know, was to go into judgment. Can't they do it better than this? What? Is this still going on? Is nobody going to step back from this? From this quality of blaming? And then I realized neither of these people has the information that I've just shared with you. Neither of them has the basic guidelines of refraining from lying and harsh speech and slander and idle speech and the cultivation of communicating what is true, appropriate, and kind. And it can all be summed up in just a few words. And yet, once we have this information, once we make the commitment to do this practice as really as a spiritual practice, out of concern for our happiness and also concern for the happiness of others, protecting our happiness. Once we have this information, then we have the tools and we have a choice. And I realized with these two people, they didn't really have a choice. They're not trained. If we are on a spiritual path, we just can't ignore communication as spiritual practice. It may be the aspect of spiritual practice that we most do. You know, we can be aware of our breath moment to moment, But so much of what we do in the course of a day is to communicate. I find it really useful not only to pay close attention to what I am saying or writing. I've been trying for 30 years now to be more and more conscious with communication. I find that I'm still harming through communication, but much less than I used to. I sometimes get caught, but I always see that I'm caught and I back away from it. It's something that we can't ignore. Our suffering comes when we resist or when we claim. That's the second noble truth. When we resist or when we cling. And I think that the forms of resistance that can happen, you know, is essentially the resistance that can be expressed through anger, for example, or the resistance that can be expressed through fear, the resistance that gets expressed through blaming, and the clinging. You know, the Buddha said that our attachment, he said there are four things that we get attached to that cause our suffering. And one of them is attachment to our views and opinions. We can't avoid having views and opinions. It's extremely important, especially in a democracy. It's extremely important for us to have views and opinions. It's not a question about trying to get rid of them. It's a question of not clinging to them, not holding on to them with a tightened fist. Is it possible for us to see that? To see our resistance, to see our grasping and clinging, and to let go of those things? That's really so much of what our practice is about. So we get caught. Of course we get caught. This heart tends to flash to anger first. And I can't tell you how many times I have regretted harming people with my anger. It's not my anger, the anger that comes into this mind. So we notice when we get caught, and then we make amends. You know, we make amends to ourselves. We forgive ourselves for whatever harm we cause. We investigate it. What have I said and why did I say it? Better yet, what am I about to say and why am I about to say it? You know, just if you could just ask those two questions. You know, what and why? If we just ask those two questions, that quality of inquiry, then we have more and more clarity and we tend not to get lost or caught. But if we do get caught, we forgive ourselves and then we ask forgiveness from others. We apologize. We apologize when we've done harm. We forgive when others have harmed us. Again, the Buddha said, he said, there are two kinds of people who store up great demerit for themselves. That is, that essentially create harmful karma for themselves, negative karma that will bring a return of pain. He said, there are two kinds, those who do not apologize when they have done harm, and those who have been harmed but refuse to forgive. And someone has apologized to them or refused to forgive. So it's so useful for us to clean up our messes as we go along. I'm trying my best to do that in my own life. So that's kind of the traditional teaching. Many of you have heard something like this from me many times. You've probably read it many times. You've probably heard it from others. I'm just wondering if this evening whether we could just take it a little bit deeper. I've shared a number of times my current favorite quotation is from Dogen Zenji, who's the founder of Soto Zen. He said, "The awakened mind is intimate with all things." I just love that. It's when things are going really well and we're really happy, it's pretty easy to be intimate. But But Dogen Zenji is saying, the awakened mind is intimate with all things. That includes the difficult situations. That includes trying to be intimate with the person we're in conflict with. Is that possible? Is it possible to get past that sense of alienation and separation in order to come to some kind of intimacy? It's just another way of putting it, but for me it really works. How can we be intimate in conflict situations? And I'd like to just suggest that there are just a couple of ways that we can do that, or some ways that we can pursue or inquire about doing that. And one is to understand, even just intellectually, much better to understand intuitively, that there isn't any self here that's in conflict. It's an illusion, this self business. The other is me and I am the other. If we actually really understand that, if you really understand that the person in front of you, whether you're in a wonderfully loving exchange with that person or whether you're in a conflictual exchange with that person, is you. And that and you are that person. Do you have some sense about how we can hold intimacy even in the midst of pain? Have you ever done that? Have you ever been in a really painful communication with someone and somehow not lost connection? That is a beautiful experience. That's a memorable experience. It happens to us, especially for those of us who are on the path and are trying. It can be quite beautiful. You know, there's a famous, I don't actually remember where it came from. It might come from the Buddha, it might come from somewhere in these thousands of years of this tradition. There's a wonderful, the image of the empty boat. You may have encountered that. So if you're in a boat and someone is rowing another boat and bumps into you, you know, really bangs into you, there can be this sense of anger. Why did you do that? You had this whole lake here and you had to run into me. But if there's an empty boat coming down the lake that bumps into you, is there the same level of anger? We're all empty boats. Do you get some sense of that? They're just empty boats bumping into each other here. It's just another way of expressing this idea of getting past the contracted and painful and separating delusion that I am a self here and everything else is it. There's me and it. So just another way of expressing this idea of this of getting past the contraction of self is this concept that is so much emphasized in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the concept of bodhicitta. And essentially bodhicitta can be translated as awakening mind or awakening heart, awakening mind heart. And it's essentially having some sense that freedom is possible, that it's really possible to wake up from this dream of suffering and to be happy. And that once you have some sense that it's possible, that freedom is possible, then your relationship with everything shifts. You realize that freedom is possible, you make a commitment to free your mind and your heart, quote, your. And at some point you make also the commitment to help others to be free. It really opens up the whole system. It becomes so much more spacious. This bodhicitta is rare even among those who follow the Buddha's teachings and practice. And what it ends up doing is it allows us to conceive of a kind of consciousness that is not egocentric, that is not always constantly self-referential, we kind of expand our identity in order to identify with all beings. So one way to put it is, I want us all to be liberated, and it doesn't matter who comes first. And for those of us who have bodhicitta, who have this sense, it's like our whole beings are directed toward helping each other to be free. I care about you. I want you to be free. Your freedom is as important to me as my freedom, quote unquote, your and my. So even just to try to imagine being free from a self and from self-centeredness. I'm assuming that if you're here in this room, it means that there's some kind of aspiration in your heart actually to get out of that contraction of self-centeredness, where so many of our thoughts and our feelings and our actions and our impulses are about protecting and gratifying this. It's fine for us to look after our needs. It's fine. But is it possible for us to somehow expand our understanding so that we're really concerned about the well-being of all? And once we've gone through that kind of expansion, then we come into conflictual situations with a very different consciousness. Just think of the Dalai Lama talking to the Chinese now since 1953. That's when he first went to Beijing. To talk to Mao Zedong. He's been in constant effort to connect to and to communicate with the Chinese government for, what is that, 56 years now? And he's still trying. The guy hasn't given up. I think it's amazing. Terribly conflictual situation. Horrific suffering. Genocide. Ethnocide. And he keeps trying. What kind of consciousness would make that possible? The guy has to be outside of the egocentric mind. He must be more spacious than that. He must be as concerned for the well-being of figures in the Chinese government as he is concerned about his own well-being. That's the only way he could sustain it. Without getting discouraged, without giving up in despair, without saying just a curse on you, which would be a simple thing to do. So maybe Paris Hilton and Alex Rodriguez may have not gotten to this aspiration yet of getting beyond egocentric thinking, but there's hope for all of us. There's a wonderful practice that can be so useful to us, and that is actually to make the effort, and try this sometime, just try it for a little while. Try to see yourself through the mind and consciousness of someone else. I just recently watched a DVD of Robert Thurman doing a teaching, and he said, you know, because of comparing mind, essentially what we do is that if we feel superior to others, then we're kind of patronizing and condescending toward them. If we feel inferior to others, we essentially feel jealousy and envy. And if we feel equal to others, then we compete with each other to get some advantage. Isn't that the way we respond? So we have these impulses, and if we can put ourselves in the minds of others, you know, so if you're feeling superior to them, then they're basically feeling resentment and jealousy and envy toward you. Just look through their eyes at yourself. If you're feeling inferior to them, then they're being patronizing and condescending toward you. Look through those eyes at yourself. If you're feeling equal to others, notice the competition in that mind. You know, to see those impulses, but also to see the sense of beautiful love and beautiful connection and compassion and caring. To actually, instead of just seeing through our own self-referencing minds is actually look through the consciousness of that person in front of you. It's a really beautiful practice. It gets us out. It gets us out of the trap. Another way of doing it, so there's this wonderful practice of seeing yourself through someone else's eyes, this is so simple, it sounds simple-minded, but it can be really useful to take interest in others, just to be interested. It actually can be transformative. Instead of, say, in a conflictual situation of going into the old habitual defensive aggressive crouch out of fear and anger, just to ask the question, what's really going on here? You know, we ask it about ourselves. What's going on in this mind and heart right now? That's the most important place to ask, to inquire. What's going on here? But also to say, well, what's going on for that person? What are they feeling and why are they feeling it? What's underlying their speech? I know what this person just said to me. Why would they say that? To get really interested. About 4 years ago, in January of 2005, I made a roots journey that was very important to me. My mother was an immigrant from Polynesia, from the South Pacific. Her name was Papawana Musamon Ateio. I grew up in rural New Hampshire in the 1940s. I'm sure my mother was the only person with Polynesian blood in the entire state. Because of racism, my mother never talked about her past. And she died when I was 18, before I was old enough to take a real interest because of the narcissism of adolescence. And so I know almost nothing about my mother's past. And I knew nothing about that part of my heritage. And I realized that because of racism, I had never claimed that heritage. So it was a very big deal for me to go to the South Pacific, to the Cook Islands in the South Pacific, to try to find the island that my family came from. My mother had a French mother and a Spanish grandmother, so she was only 1/4 Polynesian. I'm 1/8 Polynesian, not a lot, but it was a very, very important journey to me. And I went with a friend and spent about 3.5 weeks in the Cook Islands. And it was a fascinating trip. I was just absorbing all kinds of information, both intellectually but also subliminally. And it really brought something around for me in a really critically important way. One of the things my friend and I noticed is that we were extremely interested in the people we met and the culture that we were in and the environment that we were in. And essentially, nobody in 3.5 weeks expressed any interest in us. None. It was really interesting, I didn't feel offended by it because I was there to learn. I wasn't there to be seen. I wasn't there to be acknowledged. That wasn't my purpose for being there. I just wanted to understand as well as I could something that was critically important to me in terms of my own heritage. So I wasn't offended by it, but I was interested. And you might say, well, you know, we were tourists and they see too many tourists, but actually the Cook Islands are so poor and so remote that there actually isn't that much tourism. It was beautiful culture and just so many wonderful things about it, but I thought it was quite interesting. They just weren't interested. If we are interested in others, if we can take a real interest in others, then it's possible to come to a place of empathy, to say, oh, I can see how you might feel that way. You know, if somebody is being very critical of us, oh, I see. I can see how you're feeling that. understand. And then, you know, taking an interest in, and then just bringing it just a little bit deeper to this concept of deep listening. Is it possible to be fully present for another human being? Just fully present. Is it possible for us to take our own opinions and our projections and our interpretations and our distortions and put them all aside and just be there to try as well as we can to understand another human being as well as we can? It's an amazing experience. And I get to have that experience all the time in my work. Because when I'm leading a retreat, or even when I'm not leading a retreat, but when I do an interview as a spiritual teacher with someone, you know, I had 3 interviews this afternoon. You know, in a retreat, we have 15 minutes. So somebody comes in and, you know, even if I do a retreat every year, we get 15 minutes every year to sit down and talk to each other. It's ridiculous. So what do we do with that 15 minutes? And what I've learned to do from years and years and years of doing it is to put myself, my own needs, my own agenda as completely aside as possible and to be as present and aware as possible. And to try to understand what is really going on for another human being. It's amazing what you can accomplish in 15 minutes. If somebody is open to me and trusts me enough and is willing to talk about something that's important to them, we don't chat, then it's possible to kind of see the configuration of elements there, the configuration of conditions. And sometimes it's just like acupuncture, where you can just sort of intervene right there with one little thing that can actually influence the entire system. So I get to do deep listening all the time, and it's quite amazing. It's so powerful. One feels so alive at a time like that. Is it possible for us to, you know, story? Are you familiar with StoryCorps? It's the Smithsonian Institution for a few years now has been doing wonderful stuff. They're taking oral histories from all over the country and they're basically archiving them at the Smithsonian. You may have heard some of these StoryCorps. They can be extraordinarily powerful on NPR. The kind of the motto of StoryCorps is, listening is an act of love. How do we get to that place of actually, you know, it's easy to say those words, they sound so pretty, but how do we actually get to the place where it becomes an act of love to listen to another human being? And essentially, love is connection, is being really connected, even if that being is angry with you. So we practice. I want to share with you a secret device that I have that is just wonderful. I'm a shy person, and I've never liked parties. Some people just love to go to a party, and you know they get all energized by it. But I'm an introvert, and I'm shy, and it's hard for me to go into a crowd of people. And what I figured out years and years and years ago is that the secret to social success is only 2 things: smile warmly and listen well. And if I go into any group and smile warmly and listen well, genuinely listen well, it always works. It's so simple. I can feel comfortable in any crowd if I just remember to do those 2 things. And I don't feel shy anymore. It's pretty simple, but essentially it has to do with deep listening. Somebody who listens, who can really be present for others, who isn't just listening long enough for the other person to stop so they can say whatever they have to say, but is actually interested and present and inquiring and investigating and wondering what's really happening here. What is this? What's going on? Our personalities are so weird, so they're so wonderful to study. All of us, we all have weird personalities. Anyone who listens well and who truly wants to know about others is eagerly sought out and very much appreciated. People like to be seen and acknowledged. It's that simple. And if we take an interest in them, if we try to do deep listening. And then finally, just one other possible way of kind of getting out of our egocentricity in order to come into intimacy with others, especially in situations where there can be conflict, where there's some kind of difficulty or tension or trouble. And that is to consider whether one's critic is speaking some truth. You know, if we're really defensive, we're not going to hear at all what they're saying. And in one Buddhist tradition, the language actually is not useful. And I think this is just a poor English translation, but it's called driving all fault into oneself. So there is no fault. I mean, this is poor language. But it's basically saying, is the critic, can I learn something from the person who is being critical? Is there some truth in what they're saying? And in order to get to that place, it means having to give up needing to be right. You know, what's more important to you, to learn something and to be in harmony or to be right? And you know what, the answer seems obvious, but next time you're in conflict with someone, you might ask yourself that question. Is it more important to learn something and to be in harmony or to be right? And which one do we usually go for? So one of the accusations that got thrown back and forth between two people I know who have been in this wonderful conflict with each other is one said, you know, you're just so selfish. And then I just step back and I objectively look at the person who's accused of being selfish. And this person told me, for one thing, that they have not listened to or watched the news for 5 years. So all of the trouble and suffering of the world is out there somewhere. It just doesn't exist for this person. And as I look how they live their lives, and I'm not saying this in a critical way, I'm saying it in an objective way, is mostly their lives are lived to gratify themselves and to be as comfortable as possible. That there isn't a sense of extending toward others. There isn't a sense of generosity. There isn't a sense of being concerned about the needs of others. So there's some truth. You know, if we could just sort of take out the negative language as you're selfish, there is a lot of egocentricity there from what I can tell. And it would be so useful if that person, and I don't know if it's going to happen, and I'm not going to be the one to point it out. But it would be so useful that for that person to say, gee, I wonder if that's true. I wonder if there is a lot of self-concern here. You know, again, it's important for us to make sure that our needs are met. It's not about that. It's really about saying to ourselves on some level, your needs are as important as my needs. Your perspective is as important as my perspective. Your truth is as important as my truth. So just a few ways that we might, you know, just to follow the very traditional guidelines of the Buddha about what to refrain from in our communication and what to cultivate in order to protect our happiness and to protect the happiness of others. And then if it's possible, to see if it's possible to be intimate in conflict situations by somehow getting out of our egocentricity enough to try to understand the reality of another. to see that there is no self here, to see that they're only empty boats bumping up against each other, to take interest in others, to try to do deep listening, to see if it's possible whether the person who is being critical of us is actually speaking some truth. If this talk helps even one of us in this room to be a little more skillful in our communication, it's really worth the effort. And that's my hope. My hope is that we find a way to talk and write with each other in a way, even when we disagree profoundly, to do it in a way that is harmonious and kind. It's really possible instead of separating. So thank you for your patience.